I thought I'd start off with a quote that might not be directly related to agronomy or pasture science, but Picasso, of all people, was reputed to have said that good artists borrow and great artists steal. He wasn't meaning that he was an enormous plagiarist, but rather that much of our greatest art, and it applies to science as well, is taking something we already know or that we think we already know and transforming it, applying it in a novel way. And Lucerne, one of our subjects tonight, has been feeding human stock since at least the time of the ancient Romans. And when you have a look, agricultural writers of that time were well aware of the importance of legumes in general. New Zealand's agricultural history has been closely aligned with ryegrass and white clover, but as the sheep flock and the beef herds ended up higher and drier, is the term we use, by the switch of land to dairying and dairy support, the limitations of white clover have become more and more apparent. And so some of us are focusing on old timers, to call them that, such as sub clover and red clover. But lucerne too was once a huge part of New Zealand's pastoral production before it disappeared from large areas in around about the early 80s. But in the past decade or so, or probably a wee bit longer, lucerne's undergone something of a renaissance. So tonight we're going to talk about what we've learned or relearned about using those species in our farm systems, the new ways of applying them, and we'll talk a wee bit about the reasons why they went out of favour as well, because that'll influence how we manage them in the future. And with us tonight, we have the man whose research, teaching, and dare I say it, preaching, has been a big part in their resurgence. So welcome to the call, Derek Moot, Professor of Plant Science at Lincoln University. So before we move on to some of the technical stuff, and you've got some thoughts and things, maybe you can just set the scene a little. You were a Lincoln grad, so tell us a wee bit what you did after that, how you ended up where you are now, and I guess one of the interesting stories you've told is what you found when you came back to Lincoln and started your research career.
Thanks, Aaron, and it's great to be with people on the call tonight. Yes, I finished Lincoln. I did a PhD working on peas, of all things, and went overseas, went to the UK, and did my postdoc. And when I was in the UK, the only thing you got to talk about was beetle banks or climate change. So I worked on climate change, and I was really trying to see whether we could still grow wheat in Spain was one of the issues that I was working on. And so I got interested in climate change and whether it was a real phenomenon or not. And then I came back to New Zealand and found that climate change wasn't really on the horizon, and it wasn't a great topic to be talking about because most people weren't all that interested in it. But the other thing I found was that dryland pastures were really still ryegrass and white clover. And I'd been taught about lucerne at Lincoln University when I was a student, but it had really gone out of favour and wasn't being used very much in dryland areas. So we set about trying to work out why lucerne wasn't being used, and this was 20 years ago now, which seems like a long time when I say it, but it doesn't seem like a long time when I think about the research we've done. So 20 years ago, we asked farmers, why aren't you using lucerne? And they told us. They said, we're waiting for it to flower, and it's really only a cut-and-carry proposition. We don't really want to graze it, and it gets a lot of aphids and causes us some problems with animal health. So we set about a research program trying to answer that. And my main interest was to say, if climate change is occurring, and who knows, perhaps this winter indicates we might have, it's certainly the sort of winter that we predicted 20 years ago. This is the sort of winter that we were predicting we would have, and we're getting it now. But it doesn't really matter. Farmers on the east coast of New Zealand have always had to cope with variability of climate, either a cold spring or a dry summer or changes from one year to the next. So I set about trying to create a system or a farm system that would be a bit more resilient than what I was seeing with ryegrass and white clover that were dying within 3 or 4 years of farmers putting them into their dryland paddocks. They just weren't surviving in that harsh environment from essentially central Otago to Hawke's Bay.
Thanks, Derek. So we're going to really drill into some of the stuff. What I made a note here to mention and remind everybody at the start, and I'll remind you again at the end, that a lot of the stuff we talk about tonight is already freely available. There's some published material, but there's certainly the Lincoln University Dryland Pastures website, which is a bunch of frequently asked questions. And I know a good number of you, but not all of you, are subscribed to Beef and Lamb New Zealand's Lucerne Management Text Service, which is messages and timely reminders and alerts from Derek about lucerne management, and also you have a chance to send in your questions and get them answered if you don't get them answered tonight. So We'll include some details how to get onto those if you're not already, but a lot of what we're talking about tonight is the stuff that comes up repeatedly on those. So we've had quite a few questions about annual clover, but we'll deal with the loose end stuff first. In a nutshell, what's the big advantage for dryland farmers? It grows well. Why is lucerne? Is it just the taproot? What's the role of nitrogen as well in water use efficiency? I know you often ask a question about if you had a unlimited nitrogen or unlimited water, which would you have?
That's right, and most people would take the unlimited water. The key reason for using lucerne is it has a deep taproot, so it can get access to moisture that our grass plants can't. And there it uses that water very efficiently. So in the spring period, there's two things that are happening with the lucerne. A, it's got that deep taproot that can draw moisture from depth. And B, it uses each millimetre of water very efficiently. And that's because it's never nitrogen deficient. If I compare a dryland grass pasture with a lucerne pasture, you can see urine patches in that grass pasture. And those urine patches are usually taller and they're growing more feed, and they're indicating that our grass-dominant pastures, particularly in dryland, are very nitrogen deficient. And the key thing about that is that nitrogen is key for using the water. So a bucket of water is available in the spring, and that water disappears through evapotranspiration. And evapotranspiration is a combination of moisture that evaporates from the soil surface and water that transpires through the plant. And although that's getting a bit technical, really what it's saying is evapotranspiration occurs for a grass pasture that's nitrogen deficient and growing, let's say, 25 kilos a day, and a lucerne pasture that's growing 80 kilos a day, evapotranspiration's the same. If the ground is covered in green area, it's physics, it's the humidity, the wind speed and the temperature that dictates how quickly that water is drawn out of the bucket and therefore how efficiently the pasture is growing. Pastures that are nitrogen deficient don't use their water very efficiently. And so there's two things we need to be very aware of as we come into the spring period and when we think about using lucerne, and that is the size of the bucket, which is essentially the soil depth that you've got available to you, and whether that bucket is full. And this is a very interesting situation right now. Here at Lincoln, we've got two different soil types. We've got the stony soils at Ashley Dean that many people will be familiar with. And that bucket's full. It only takes about 80 mils of moisture to fill up that bucket. And that bucket is looking exactly the same this year as it did last year. And it's not a very big bucket. And if we don't get any rainfall through September, October, November, we can be dry by show week. And last year, we were actually having to destock our very stony soils by show week. In contrast, we've also got Templeton soils and we've got some very deep Wakanui soils. The Templeton soils this year at Lincoln have only got about 30 to 40% of what they should have if they were fully charged. So there's a bit of an issue for those people that are in my area from about Lincoln North that even the lucerne is going to struggle to be very productive for us this spring because actually there isn't a lot of soil moisture at depth in the bucket. So it's quite a precarious situation for people in our district. I know other parts of the country have had plenty of rainfall, so their bucket's full, and particularly sort of South Canterbury. I know I've had quite a bit more rainfall than we've had in North Canterbury. And they should be looking forward to a very good spring with the lucerne growing well. But the bucket is only about half full at Lincoln, and therefore I suspect from Lincoln through North Canterbury and up into the Marlborough district.
Well, look, we've had questions come in around that, and a big part of tonight's going to talk about grazing and cutting management of lucerne in the ideal year or a normal year as best we can, but there are big parts of the country where we're not going to have that this spring as best we can tell. Even lucerne won't grow. You've just explained that, in the absence of water, nothing's going to grow. Even lucerne sometimes can't cope. But people heading into a dry spring like that, what do you recommend for managing their lucerne?
They should manage it the same as they normally would. So we've actually just started grazing on our Templeton soils at Lincoln. The lucerne's about 12 centimetres high. So it's been a mild winter and the lucerne's come away okay. But if we don't get rainfall through September and October, that grazing rotation will run out fairly quickly. And the fact is, a six paddock rotational grazing system will indicate for us that we haven't got any moisture at depth because it won't regrow so quickly. So what we really need to keep an eye on is not the paddocks that are immediately ahead of us as we start grazing, but the recovery of the ones that we have grazed. And without significant rainfall through the spring, we're going to find that we run out of moisture fairly quickly. And then other decisions around weaning and those sorts of decisions will need to be made. But that's not the case for the whole of the country. That's simply the situation that we're in at Lincoln.
That's been, you know, if you put your finger on one single thing, probably in the last 20 years, certainly in the last decade, around lucerne use has been its use as a grazing plant rather than it's traditionally been a few blocks on a farm for cut and carry. And understanding the grazing management of it's been one of the keys for pasture persistence, animal performance, pasture production. We're into spring coming up, set stocking or rotational grazing in one sentence.
Rotational grazing.
Explain the difference.
So lucerne grows from the top of the plant. If we look at a lucerne plant, if you grab a stem, you'll see that there's a lot of leaves bunched at the top. That's the growing point. That's the potential growth that you've got going forward. As soon as you remove that, the plant has to produce a new stem. And the stems that we've got there at the moment are actually the product of the whole winter's regrowth. Since the last time we grazed, maybe back at the beginning of June, that plant has slowly developed those leaves and they're ready to take off in the spring. So we don't want to be set stocking lucerne at this time of the year. If we set stock, we essentially remove all those growing points and we set the lucerne back about 4 weeks. Now, I know there are some farmers that do set stock on their lucerne, and if you have got a large area, and those are the only farmers that I'd be wanting to be considering set stocking on lucerne, then if they're at about half their normal rate for set stocking, they can lightly set stock lucerne. But you want to make sure that not every stem is being eaten. And I'm loathe to tell people that they can set stock lucerne because people will, Derek Wirt said I can set stock lucerne and they'll nail it and it won't come back for them, then it'll really disappoint. So it's rotationally grazed. Start grazing when it's about 10 to 12 centimetres high in the first paddock. Go into a break, mob size, sort of 14 ewes and lambs per hectare. So if you've got 20 hectares, that's about 250, 280 ewes and lambs could fit on that 20-hectare block, and you rotate them around in, say, a five-paddock rotation, five or six-paddock rotation. Start with the first one, graze it for 3 or 4 days, move on to the next one.
So if at all possible, rotation, or there's the opportunity for some set stocking very carefully, but you mentioned the importance of having a significant area of lucerne. What's the sort of amount before, you know, where you can actually genuinely get into a decent grazing system and look after the crop?
Well, I think people need to have at least 20 hectares of lucerne before they start. We've got farmers that are now up to 50 to 60% of their whole farm is in lucerne, and those are the farmers that I'm talking about. You know, they've just run out of lambing area that they need to be able to put a little bit of pressure on their lucerne. But if you've got one block of 20 hectares or a block that you can cut up, that's where I would say you start to really see the benefits of it. A 5-hectare paddock is probably still a cut-and-carry proposition. Mm-hmm. 20 hectares starts to give you some decent growth. For a lot of people, that 20 hectares might be an area that they put the hoggets on, and then all of a sudden they see the hoggets are doing very well through the spring period and they're putting on the weight on their hoggets. But I think a 20-hectare block is a good investment and gives you the returns that you want to see from putting in some lucerne.
One of the terms you'll hear us bandy around sometimes is talking about a lucerne conversion, because, for example, dairy conversions we've all heard about. The dairy farmer doesn't do it one paddock at a time. It's all in so they can set up the ideal system and go for that. Just on that, though, there are some times when people are, for whatever reason, have both grass and lucerne. Are there any animal health issues or any issues to be considered with a ruminant going on and off from lucerne to grass to lucerne? Or is there a transition?
It's better not to do that if you can help it. Essentially, the rumen has the bugs in it that will digest or break down the feed that the animal's eating. And if they've been on grass for a long period of time, then the bugs that are going to break down the grass are in the ascendancy or in the highest numbers in the rumen. And then when you put them on a feed, like a change of diet onto a brassica, same as a change of diet onto a lucerne, then the bugs that actually digest the lucerne need to have the opportunity to grow. One of the key things I would suggest is that if you've got that 20 hectares, one mob stays on that lucerne and it goes round. If it's ewes and lambs, then there's a real benefit of those ewe lambs, maybe your replacement lambs, some of them will come out of that mob. They've actually grazed lucerne from the start of their life. So their rumen develops well, and it develops the ability to digest. So when you wean and those weaned lambs go onto the lucerne, that rumen is already developed with lucerne in it, and therefore you don't get the check that you can get if you're taking a set of weaned lambs off grass-based pastures and putting them onto lucerne. Often people are a bit disappointed by the growth rates they get off the weaned lambs when they put them on lucerne, but the highest growth rates for the animals will come if they've actually been eating, you know, mum's milk and lucerne is a pretty good combination for them to start life on.
So we've talked about why rotational grazing is preferred, the difference of the growth points at the tip versus at the base. But the other key aspect around grazing management is about managing the root reserves under the surface as well for longevity, spring production, all those sorts of things. So when I grew up, there was a couple of paddocks of lucerne every year for bloody small bales. I remember them well. And the rule was you wait 10% flower before you mow it. Is that the deal for grazing and or mowing?
Yeah, and I said earlier, one of the things we did was try and find out why farmers weren't using lucerne when I first came back into New Zealand, and that was the reason. They'd been told you've got to wait for 10% flowering, or some people said 1% flowering before you could use it. And the lucerne actually responds to day length, and we grew lucerne that was 60 centimetres tall, and it still hadn't flowered. In that sort of scenario, the lucerne becomes a cut and carry proposition only. So we set about doing some research looking at what happens to the lucerne as it grows through the spring. And in the spring, it's remobilizing a huge amount of carbon and nitrogen. About 3 tonnes of dry matter comes from the root reserves above ground to grow the shoots. So that's one of the reasons it's really efficient at using water in the spring, is because actually it's growing more than it could just based on the sunshine it's capturing. It's putting 3 tonnes of carbon and nitrogen above ground and giving you a great flush of growth. If we wait to graze until that paddock gets to 1% flowering, it's become stemmy and lignified, and we can't really even start a rotation because the next paddock's going to be even more mature. And what we really want is to get farmers onto their lucerne when it's about 10, 15 centimetres high is ideal in the first paddock, and they will then be eating just vegetative herbage, and we don't really need to worry about that flowering in the spring. We do need to worry about in the autumn. So autumn, there's only 2 seasons for a lucerne plant. There's spring, when it's remobilising reserves from underground, and there's autumn, when it's putting it back under. So in the autumn, we often find the lucerne doesn't respond as well as it should. We think it should be growing more than it is. Actually, it's still producing a huge amount of sugar from photosynthesis, but it's putting that 3 tonnes back under the ground to set itself up for the following year. So if we're looking for flowering, the time when we want it is in the autumn. We don't need that flowering to occur in the spring. And it's certainly one of the reasons that farmers weren't using it as a grazing proposition when I came back and first started asking why lucerne wasn't a major part of the dryland farm system.
So the rule of thumb for that, when you spell it, how much flowering to get that recharge?
Let's just say sometime in the autumn, so sometime from mid-January on, if you can give the lucerne a 6-week growing period, that's active growth, not, oh, it's dry, therefore I can give my lucerne a rest, but 6 weeks of actively growing, and it will probably flower during that time. That's a good period of time for it to have that recharge. Now, I know some people don't get that opportunity to give it that break until sort of March or April. And at that time, if you leave it for 6 weeks, the lucerne may not flower, but it's the period of time that you've left it for that's important. We use the flowering as a visual sign that the plant's going to be recharging underground, but it doesn't always flower if you're getting later into the autumn before you get a chance to give it a rest.
And same rules for those that are cutting?
Same rules for those that are cutting, although the cutting people may see flowers more frequently because they're trying to take a higher yield off their lucerne. And they may see some flowers in the spring period, but same thing, they really need to recharge that underground reserve in the autumn.
So just a specific question on that, what sort of ideal height for taking a cut for hay, baleage, silage?
It depends on whether you're buying or selling. So the heavier lucerne you'll get will be 45 to 50 centimetres tall, but when you're cutting that, about, let's say that 50 centimetres is 5 tonnes of biomass, 2.5 tonnes of it will be good quality leaf and the palatable stem at the top. The other 2.5 tonnes will be stemmy and fibrous. So the 2.5 tonnes of nice leaf and palatable stem has got an ME of 12, so it's very high quality feed. The stem's got an ME of 8. So if you add them two together, your hay's got an ME of 10. It's not bad, but when we're grazing, we were getting plenty of feed that's got that ME of 12. So we'd rather be grazing a stand at 30 centimetres or 25 to 30 centimetres tall rather than leaving it to get to that 40, 45, 50 centimetres that we would for a hay crop.
So that just had a question come in to clarify that around spring rotations. You're talking around about a 6-week rotation?
I'm talking about anywhere between about 35 and 40 days in the spring, because you'll often find the regrowth is very quick. So the first paddock I go on to might be on it for 3 or 4 days. The second paddock might be another 3 or 4 days. By the time I get to the last paddock, that could be 35 centimetres tall. So what you're really looking to do is come back into the first paddock that you grazed when it's about 25, 30 centimetres tall. So the idea of that first initial grazing is to set up a rotation so that in the second round of grazing, all of the stands are about 30 centimetres tall. That 30 centimetres is about 3 tonnes in the spring on average. You know, just as a rule of thumb, it's about 3 tonnes. And 2.5 tonnes of that will still be the very high quality feed that we want grazing animals to be eating.
All right. Look, this is we're going over the key points as best we can and amalgamating questions. There's a lot to this stuff. And as I said, there's other ways of finding information. So I'm going to keep moving on. I want to get now, we've talked about some of the basics about grazing, managing the lucerne persistence production, but it all starts with actually getting the crop in the ground, the lucerne stand established, weed-free, which is, if you've seen the questions that come in, well, most of them are about weeds, so it's a big issue. So what's the process? How long would you start planning before drilling day? When would you drill? What are some of the key things people need to think about?
There isn't a... This season, if you're just thinking about going into lucerne now, is probably the wrong time to be thinking about it. You should have been thinking about it last year. It depends on, as always, it depends on what you're coming out of. So if you're coming out of a brassica crop and you've got your fertility up for your brassica crop, and you're coming towards the end of that, you've grazed it off, then that would be a great time to be thinking about putting a lucerne stand in now. But if you're just making a decision, I've got an old pasture and I want to take it out and put it in lucerne this spring, I probably wouldn't. I'd be thinking about going through a crop, summer crop, or looking at it for a winter crop, and making sure you clean up any of those hard-to-get weeds, Californian thistles, yarrow, twitch. Those are the things we want cleaned out of a lucerne stand before we start drilling. So, the planning depends on what sort of weeds you've got and how long it's going to take you to control them.
The other thing we want for good lucerne performance, persistence, establishment is the right pH and soil fertility.
Yes.
You want to talk about the minimums and are there any maximums?
Minimums, lucerne is actually quite robust, and in New Zealand we grow it even when the pH is down at about 5.5, but that's not ideal for it. We'd prefer it to be 5.8, 6, and if we're in the US, if we said we're growing at a pH of 6, they'd laugh at us saying, well, it should be 7. In New Zealand, 7's probably getting a bit high for what we want to be dealing with. It's expensive to put on that much lime, and we're pretty comfortable when we get around 6. 5.8, 6.2 is what I think is a good compromise. What that does is it makes the molybdenum available, makes the boron available, and makes the phosphorus available. And one of the things that's really important for lucerne is that you get some phosphorus available at establishment. Phosphorus for all our crops, whether it's a swede crop or a lucerne crop, phosphorus is key at establishment. When the plant is just young, the first 6 weeks of growth, it needs phosphorus to set up its photosynthesis system, and it also needs phosphorus to start doing nitrogen fixation. Those are very energy-hungry processes, and phosphorus is the energy source in our plant. So it's important that we get some phosphorus, particularly at drilling. We want to put some phosphorus underneath the plants. If you can drill some phosphorus into the stand, that would be important. So I'm talking about Olsen peas there in our mid-teens to high-teens range. That's where we want our Olsen pea to be. Our pHs are around 5.8. Sulfur, if we're applying superphosphate, then we're getting our sulfur levels with our superphosphate. We're getting the sulfur coming in there. The other thing, trace elements, people often get a bit concerned about molybdenum and boron. Just keep an eye on your pH. If your pH is around that six figure, then your molybdenum should be fine, and you only really need to worry about it if you've got a herbage test that says you've got low molybdenum and low boron. I wouldn't go out of my way to be putting those on specifically as trace elements unless you've got a problem. I'd be looking at the boron and the molybdenum as part of a lucerne mix, and they're really important if you are in a cut and carry situation. So a traditional lucerne mix from a fertiliser company will often have high potassium levels and molybdenum and boron as trace elements put into the mix, and that's because a lot of potassium gets removed when you cut and carry lucerne. If you graze lucerne, of course, the urine puts that potassium back into the stand, and so there isn't as much of a problem. But cut and carry, if you've got one paddock that you're cut and carrying the whole time, it's potassium, molybdenum, and boron that will be the three that drop, and therefore your fertiliser mix will need to contain those.
Is there a risk? We've had the odd question around boron and molybdenum. Is there a risk with putting too much of those on, or is it possible to put too much on?
It's an interesting question, Aaron. From an animal health perspective, probably not. We've actually got a couple of situations where farmers or fruit reps have got the decimal point wrong, and we've put on, instead of putting on grams, we've been putting on kilograms per hectare, and we've been advising those people just to keep an eye on the grazing, but we haven't had any issues with, from an animal health perspective, of excess molybdenum and boron at this stage. But, you know, it does happen. Sometimes people think they should be putting on, you know, kilograms per hectare when in fact it's grams per hectare that we're dealing with.
Cost an extra bit of money rather than...
Yeah, it costs a bit of money and not really a great benefit from doing it.
Through the text management service, I know we certainly try and encourage people at least 12 months out to be looking at their crops. Weeds are one of the biggies. The other one that keeps coming up is pH, because that takes longer to adjust or address than phosphorus, potassium, sulfur. Do people need to start correcting pH well in advance, or can they do it at the same time as the lucerne's establishing, you know, be putting lime on through that establishment period?
Yeah, that's why I quite like the idea of going for a brassica crop or something first, so you can address those soil fertility issues before you go into your lucerne stand. So if you're coming out of rye corn or you're coming out of a brassica crop, do the fertility at that point. pH actually changes quite quickly. The soil solution changes quite quickly. Within a few days of us actually putting the lime on, if we've got moisture there. But the chemical changes at the soil surface don't always make all of the nutrients available so quick. So, yeah, it can take about 6 months for that pH to come up. People should be, if they're looking to soil test, the soil test should be being done in the autumn. That's when our sulfur levels are the most stable. So any time April, May is a good time to be taking your soil test. And then addressing that, you can apply superphosphate, for example, probably after the first cut or the first grazing in spring is a good time from a maintenance perspective. But a pre-establishment situation, you should be putting that on with your crop preceding the lucerne going in.
Soil testing in the autumn, late autumn?
Yes.
But you recommend herbage testing in spring to complement that?
Herbage testing in spring, once your lucerne's established, if you think you've got a problem of any description. Sometimes we find the lucerne is just growing so fast, and you know, 150 kilos of dry matter per hectare per day, it can actually come up with some things like potassium deficiency, which is soil tested, say you've got plenty of potassium, but actually your herbage test will tell you you're a bit deficient. And sulfur is the one that can be trip us up occasionally. I know it hasn't happened much this year, but if we have a very wet winter, sulfur will leach out of the profile, and so sulfur can be one that we need to get on. And sulfur deficiency sort of looks like nitrogen deficient. The plants look a bit yellow and washed out, and so it looks like we should put nitrogen on. In fact, it's a sulfur deficiency, so that's the one we keep an eye on. That's with an established stand. If we're going into establishment, sulfur levels are generally taken care of by making sure the P level's up around that 15 figure.
Sowing time or date, spring or autumn, any preference, and if so, why?
High preference for spring. Very few situations where I would be recommending autumn sowing. We've done a lot of work on sowing time at Lincoln. For us, the best time to go in is about the second week of October. And the reason for that is it gives us a growing season ahead of us. And when that lucerne starts growing, it gets to about 15 centimetres tall and looks like it's not doing anything. What it's actually doing is growing its roots, and it's growing its roots at about a centimetre a day, and they're going down the profile. And it needs to grow about 5 tonnes of biomass in the top 30 centimetres of the soil. That's 5 tonnes of roots in that top spade depth before it will behave like a mature lucerne stand and be good for grazing. And the best time for it to do that is the spring when it's got its best growing conditions. Now, having said that, when you do that in the autumn, if you autumn sow, we've got a double whammy. So there's two things happening. The photoperiod tells the plant that it should be putting things under the ground, and at establishment it's trying to do the same. So the lucerne's not very competitive in the autumn, and your weeds will overtake it. So unless you have a very particular situation, and you know, if this was an Australian call show, we'd be having a different conversation, because they're looking to build up their moisture through the summer and then drill in the autumn. But if you've got very light soils, maybe you're on a sandy soil or a very light soil, you might build up some soil moisture through summer, spring, summer, build it up, and then go in early autumn and put in a stand. But there's, you know, very unusual situation to be recommending autumn sowing. Generally, we've got to be going in the spring. We will get weeds that we have to deal with. If we haven't done a good job of our pre-emergent, we can use a pre-emergent spray, or we can use post-emergent methods. So post-emergence of the lucerne is about 15 centimetres high, and you've got a weed mass coming through, graze it. Go in and graze it, and the animals will take out most of those weeds, and then let it grow. Let the lucerne grow until it flowers in that first establishment period.
And we've had lots of specific weed questions, which we're probably not going to get to them all tonight, but it is the most common questions we get in on the text message service as well. So if you're not already, sign up and send them in by that, and we'll get you some personalised advice or deal with it.
And just on that, Aaron, on our frequently asked questions on the website, where we've got weed questions, we've actually asked farmers to tell us what they're doing, because sometimes they're doing things that are off-label. One of the issues with something like lucerne is that nobody's going to register a lot of products for the use on lucerne, because it just doesn't make sense for them commercially to be doing it. So we can't advocate what people are doing, but people are indicating the sorts of things they're doing for some of the hard to control weeds, and we've just recorded those on our website.
Establishment method, cultivation, direct drilling, any preferences, any recommendations?
It depends on your weed spectrum. You can establish lucerne direct drilled and conventional cultivation very successfully both ways. The key thing to remember if you are direct drilling is you're often going to need 2 or 3 herbicide sprays. So you definitely would want to be having an autumn spray. And so let's assume you've got a lot of brown top in the pasture and you're trying to deal with that. When it greens up in the autumn, you've got to get some translocatable herbicide, some Roundup or something on it. Kill that. Hold that moisture through the winter. Put your rye corn crop in if you want to. And you're going to need to put some nitrogen on that rye corn crop. But you need the nitrogen to break down all that grass. That grass is essentially carbon, and the bugs that will break that carbon down need nitrogen. So you often have, you know, 100 kilos of N actually helps break down that carbon mat and therefore give you better pasture establishment. Now, that doesn't matter if it's lucerne or a pasture. Direct drilling is a lot of carbon that we've got to get rid of. Often in high country areas, the farmers will go through 2 or 3 crops of rye corn before they'll go into their lucerne, just to break down that thatch and get a decent seed bed.
So we're talking seed, preparation of the seed bed, soil fertility and pH correction, weed control before, during, after. There's a lot of costs in there. Does the cost stack up?
The costs stack up, but so do the benefits. And if I look at the cost of establishing a lucerne stand, I consider it no more expensive than establishing a good ryegrass white clover pasture. The same things need to be done. The fertility's got to be dealt with. The weed control's got to be dealt with. But you're getting a better quality feed out the other end, and particularly in dry land, one that'll last longer and give you feed when you need it in the spring.
And we actually have got some good information. I know Boyd McDonald, Lone Star Farms, did a good analysis of what it was costing to do some fairly large areas into lucerne and what they actually made off that, even with all the extra costs. So we'll link to that when we send the email out afterwards. So got the lucerne in, established, and grazing it. We've talked about the ideal rotation and the rotation length for the good of the lucerne, good of the animals. But there are some animal health issues arise with lucerne. I just want to talk a wee few about those. I mean, maybe just start, what are the key ones and what are the steps everybody should be taking when grazing lucerne to look after their animals on?
Yep. So that everybody needs to be doing steps. We need salt. We need salt out even if we're next to the sea. Doug Avery's property right next to the salt works, he still puts salt out. And that's just straight sodium chloride that's required. Lucerne stores its sodium in the roots, so the animals don't get enough sodium from just grazing on the lucerne. Sometimes you'll see them picking around the edges on the weeds or the grass, and they'll go for that. So we need to make sure that we get sodium out. When the lucerne is very lush in the spring, so when we've had a dryish spring, we actually find we get reasonably high live weight gains and we get fewer animal health problems. When we have lush lucerne in the spring, that's our highest risk period for grazing lucerne. So we can get clostridial bacteria and we can get red gut. And red gut is simply that we get very lush herbage that passes through the rumen quickly and it twists. And as it twists, it then stops passing through altogether and the animals die. Now, a lot of people think they have red gut, and we can avoid red gut two ways. One of them is to have some fibre out in that very lush lucerne, particularly if you've had a wet spring, make sure there's some fibre out. And one of the things I used to say, that it doesn't really matter what the quality of that fibre is, but I'm probably changing my thinking a bit on that and saying actually the better quality that fibre, so if it was lucerne hay, for example, the differential in the feed will mean more animals are likely to go and eat that fibre. Whereas if it's some old barley straw, fewer animals will eat it. So you're increasing the risk of them not eating the fibre. So fibre needs to be available when it's lush in the spring. We need to ensure that we've got our vaccinations up to speed. So people often think they've got a problem with red gut, and it may not be. It might actually be clostridial diseases. And what happens with clostridium on all high-quality feeds, they could be eating Italian ryegrass, they could be eating lucerne, you'll see that the single lamb is just looking fantastic, and then it drops down dead. And it's usually been overwhelmed by clostridial disease. So our vaccination program is important. Talk to your vet, but you've got to be in that sort of two-week period pre-lambing to make sure that we're getting those antibodies taken through into the colostrum so that the lamb's getting it. And then we need to be doing a follow-up. If we're going to keep those lambs on the property and grow them out, we need to be looking about giving a second vaccination to them, particularly if they're growing fast and they've been on lucerne their whole life.
Can you comment on any benefits of 10-in-1 over 7-in-1, 5-in-1?
Well, I'm not a vet, but I'll tell you what they've told me. Uh-huh. So they've told me 5-in-1 is just as good as 10-in-1 for sheep, because actually the 10-in-1, some of the clostridial strains it's dealing with are not actually in New Zealand. And the 7-in-1, the extra ones are actually for cattle and not really there for sheep. Having said that, whenever people go to 10-in-1, they tend to do a better job of their vaccination because it costs them a bit more. So they're a bit more meticulous about it, and therefore they seem to find better results from going to the 10-in-1. But that's the best information I have. I think 5-in-1 done properly is absolutely fine. I know people swear by going to 10-in-1, but the vets tell me that there's not necessarily an advantage to doing that. But getting your vaccination right and thinking about that, I may need to do, to, if I'm going to keep the lambs, I may need to actually vaccinate the lambs is a key point in that.
One of the things, and we certainly see this on the text messaging service, one of the signs of death by clostridial is an animal that blows up quickly and decomposes quickly. And we get constantly people asking us about bloat in sheep, but it doesn't happen.
It can do, but it's more rare. They'll become more uncomfortable and blow, but that blowing up is generally a clostridial issue. But it's good that you mentioned the bloat, because one of the things some farmers have indicated is to try and deal with that lush lucerne, they might actually just mow their lucerne, so mow 3 or 4 strips in a paddock 2 or 3 days before they're going to put the animals in. So by doing that, they're doing two things. One of them, they don't have to put the fibre out. because they've actually got some cut lucerne already in the paddock. And the second one is the animals will then go to that and eat that wilted lucerne. They've concentrated up the sugar in that. The dry matter content is decreased, and the animals can get some of that fibre as they're eating. So that, again, is something to think about if you've gone through a dry period and we get a flush of moisture. Like last year, we had a big rainfall event around Christmas, New Year. You're going back to having to think about the animal health problems that you had in early spring when you've had that extra rainfall come through. So same thing. I don't want people out there with mowers on their lucerne all the time, but, you know, we need to be aware that there are risks and we can deal with those risks.
But on that, we've had questions about cattle, bulls, milking sheep, dairy, young stock. With those precautions, is there any stock class you wouldn't graze lucerne with?
No. Okay. They're all able to be grazed on lucerne, but perhaps the highest risk would be young cattle because they can gorge. But the issues are around managing the lucerne, knowing what you're doing. So the first time they see it, having that fibre out or cutting before they go into it, and also shifting them a half a day before you think you should. One of the things that happens is farmers often think, oh, I should shift those animals, and they go away and do a day's work and then come back at the end of the day and shift the animals. They haven't eaten for a day. They've got an empty gut, and then you move them onto a fresh break. And so you're creating two things, an empty gut, which means they're not growing for that day, and the higher risk of them gorging when they move on to the next break. So I'm much more happy, particularly when people get into a later cycle, you know, with weaned lambs, for example, that they use those weaned lambs to take the top off the lucerne, maybe mix with some cattle, that's fine, but don't leave them on there to eat every last bit of lucerne that there is in the paddock. Shift them on when there's still a little bit of leaf on the lucerne, when the stem's just sitting there, and bring in your ewes afterwards, or bring in a mob of cattle afterwards. So the mixed grazing works really well, and that's a way to introduce the cattle to the lucerne as well.
And flowering lucerne, any major issues there? High bloat risk, estrogen risk, anything we've got to worry about there?
Not really. The high flowering is not really an issue in terms of estrogen at all. In terms of bloat, it's just we come back to the same issues. The flowering often happens because we've had very hot conditions, and people just need to keep an eye on two things: a change in weather conditions, so a very hot day. If you come up and have a 28, 30 degree day and you've just shifted your animals, those tend to be days when we, anecdotally, people tell me those are the days that they have the highest risk of bloat. But the plant flowering by itself is not a risk of bloat. And it's interesting that you mentioned estrogen. We've got a PhD, very good PhD student of mine working on estrogen at the moment, and she's been through and looked at the stage of growth of lucerne, and there's no relationship between whether it's vegetative or flowering as to whether it's got high estrogens. So she's got some data to come out on that. If people are interested, they can also go to our website. We've got some very detailed information about estrogen. The biggest issue, so we're talking an autumn mating issue, her main result would be that it is fungi that cause estrogen to be a problem. So if you've got lucerne, doesn't matter whether it's vegetative or flowering, if it's got fungi, it's more susceptible to having high estrogens. Young stock seem to be more susceptible to that estrogen reducing their ovulation rate, so you can get up to a 20% drop in conception. The timing of lambing doesn't tend to change, the timing for conception doesn't, but the number of multiples does. So that's your highest risk. And I think Rachel would be happy if I told you that if you're grazing lucerne because you want to put some weight on the animals prior to mating, if you remove them, if you've got high risk lucerne that does look as though it's got some fungi, and that's where the flowering comes in, because the flowering tends to be older. Wow. It's not the flowering that's a problem, it's if you've got leaf spots on it that it becomes a problem. She'll tell you that 3 weeks is fine. So if you remove them 3 weeks before mating, that's a long enough period to not have an issue with it. I know 2014, there were a number of farmers said to me they had a problem. And if we think about 2014, April, May, we got some big rainfall events, which would have increased the risk of fungi on the lucerne when it was being eaten. And therefore, it's highly likely that those drops were due to high estrogen in the lucerne. So again, we know a lot more about it. We know we can manage it. It can be done, and we know what the risk factors are. The detail of that we're still working on, get more of that to come out as she completes her PhD.
All right, I've got one last sort of general question on lucerne stuff, and then we might talk a wee bit more about some of the other annual legumes and some other bits and pieces. But back in the heyday of lucerne, we had one variety, Wairau, and for a while we had two, Torless and Kaituna. Now we've got at least 20 or more. Any differences? I don't know how much you can say, but any significant differences between varieties or between varieties for grazing and cutting?
Lucerne is good. And that's sort of where I'll stop. I think the thing that people need to think about is what they want their lucerne for. There are some winter active type lucernes around. People are talking about winter activity, so that's something I'd be looking at. If you have a winter active lucerne, that means it's taller in the autumn. It will grow you maybe a ton of extra feed in that autumn period, but it is highly likely to only last 4 or 5 years compared with 7 or 8 years that you'd expect out of the other cultivars. From a cultivar perspective, I think it's who you've got a good relationship with that's going to give you good agronomic backup advice. That's where I'd be going more than which cultivar is better than which cultivar. If you've got someone that you can work with that knows about lucerne agronomy, they'd be the people that I'd be, you know, the cultivar differences are minimal rather than it being anything that farmers should worry about. Well, I'd still avoid Wairau. I know Wairau is sold out there, but we do increase the risk of aphids and stem nematodes being a problem if we have Wairau.
Those pest resistant things that you want to look for.
We do want the ones that are pest resistant. There's certainly been some progress in the pest resistance. The thing to think about also is, you know, aphids are a problem. They can still be a problem, particularly in a mild winter. If we come into the spring and you get a big build-up of aphids, you can get some issues with that. So we do have the ability to spray the aphids, but the least of an issue is if we're in a grazing rotation, because we'll graze them off, and it might be the last paddock in the rotation that gets covered in aphids, not every paddock in the rotation. And it's not that expensive to spray the aphids if we need to. They haven't gone away, they're still around, but we've got resistance in the more modern cultivars, and we've got grazing management ways of dealing with them.
Okay, so look, just going to move on to some more general questions or specific questions, a few questions about some of the other legumes that we have, and one in particular, red clover I mentioned at the start has been a long-term prospect in New Zealand agriculture, but there's certainly a bit more interest in it lately. Question here is where we've got high soil aluminium. So this is above 3 in the soil test, in the subsoil. Is red clover a better option for a dryland legume, even though it's obviously a shorter term proposition?
Yeah, that is a good question. The first thing I'd do if I'm concerned about aluminium is I'd actually be testing where that aluminium is. If it's only one bit of aluminium in the top 15 to 30 centimetres, I'd be putting lime on. And if I can incorporate that lime, that would be fantastic, and then I can put the lucerne. But I'd actually be soil testing down to at least half a metre, and so if the aluminium is high all the way down, then it's definitely not a lucerne proposition. Red clover is still going to struggle in that environment. It's better than the lucerne. Lucerne's our most susceptible. The plant that actually tolerates it, there's two plants that actually tolerate it, three really, Caucasian clover. Getting seed of that's quite difficult, but Caucasian actually handles aluminium reasonably well. Lotus will handle the aluminium, and in a more extensive system, then we've obviously got the perennial lupins, which handle that high aluminium as well. But it's really important that people think about their aluminium test if they've got an issue. We've been to several properties where farmers were going to put a paddock into lucerne and they sampled it and went, oh, I'm not putting that one in because down to 50 centimetres was all high aluminium. Right. But they had another paddock where there was only, you know, one thin layer of aluminium in the topsoil. And we can deal with that. So you can put lime on that. We're currently trialling a lime blower where we blow lime down to about 30 centimetres in the profile. And we'll get some results from another PhD student this spring on whether that's worked or not. So we can deal with it if it's in the top area that we can get to with lime. We can't deal with it if it's all the way down the profile.
The next question, I'm not sure whether you can comment on this one, Sulla. We've had a question about Sulla as another legume with condensed tannins, is it?
Yeah, Sulla is a legume with condensed tannins and was very, very fashionable about 10 or 15 years ago. The difficulty with Sulla has been in trying to get it to regrow after grazing, so it's quite short-lived. And people have tried to make silage out of it. It's quite difficult to ensile because it gets quite thick stems. So, I'm probably not as enamoured, not as much favoured a wood cellar as I would be if you could go with lucerne, or I'd probably go with the red clover before I went with the cellar. The condensed tannins sound great, and if we could get cellar that was easily grazed and we could graze it like we do a lucerne proposition, then I'd be comfortable. But in all the work we've done, a lot of work was done at Massey on cellar, we struggled to get it to regrow quick enough and give us the production that we got out of the lucerne.
Now, the good old subclover, a couple of questions around there. How we talked about the sensitivity to pH and soil fertility and those for establishing lucerne. How sensitive to those sorts of things is subclover?
So subclover is also sensitive to the aluminium, but less so than the lucerne. Subclover needs phosphorus. So our trifoliums, white clover, red clover, subclover, they all need phosphorus, so there's no free lunch with them. Again, because they're doing nitrogen fixation, that's an energy process, and phosphorus is our energy. So we've got to make sure our Olsen P is reasonably good, and we've got to get our pH up, again, around 5.6, 5.7. We've got a lot of subclover work just going on at the moment. We've got a Sustainable Farming Fund program that Beef and Lamb are supporting us with, and we'll have a lot more information about sub coming out over the next few years. We've just put out a publication on sub that people can download from us, identifying the different subclover cultivars as we've got them. And we've got trial sites from Omarama right through to Gisborne on trying to look at using sub. The interest in sub is because it's our earliest growing annual legume and our most widely spread. So we've got a whole suite of new annual legumes that are around. We've got arrowleaf clover, Persian clover, Balancer clover. Those are all what we call top flowering annuals, and probably require specialist management, whereas people are probably more familiar with sub in their pastures. And the key thing about sub is it is an early growing legume, and when we want high quality feed in the spring, sub is the plant that can do it, and we've had a lot of interest coming through in sub. So getting sub going is our current research target.
There was a key point, I think somebody was saying, is in low fertility areas or given the short growth and it's an annual, is it worth putting fertiliser, particularly P, on for sub? And you're saying,
yes, it is, definitely. It's definitely, sub needs, it needs lime, and often it becomes lime sulphur if your P is already in the sort of 15 level, and but your pH is down at 5.2, 5.3, you've got a problem. We don't need to inoculate the sub, is one issue though. It will actually survive with the white clover rhizobia that are already widespread in the soil, but we do need to make sure the fertility is there with sub. So yes, certainly do that. Now, people say it's only an 8-month thing, but you only use your water once. So if you're using your water in spring and you've got a true summer dry, then sub clover is being fantastic for us for that early spring period. Really good feed for coming on for lambing. And for anyone that's interested, some very good examples on our website from David Grigg and Will Grigg in Marlborough about how their use of annual legumes and at Tempelo in particular, just increasing their production off using subclover.
Well, one of the, you touched right about the start about climate change or increase in climate variability and some of these things. That was a question about the importance of sub and the germination in autumn for the rest of the year's production. When is it too late for sub to, or if it germinates late, when is it too late?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So this year we monitored, we had sub come through really well at Ashley Dean, our driest area, in January, and it then all died. You know, that's the typical false strike that we get off sub. Actually, if we drilled sub into pastures now, if we actually went out there and drilled it, we'd have 3 tonne of herbage by the end of October. And for some of the people that are in areas where their pastures might be dead from a couple of years of drought, that could actually be an option as the temperatures warm in this spring period. And the sub will grow. So it's never too late. It's obviously you'll get higher yields if it would ideally germinate in March, April. But any germinating sub will, if there's no competition, it will grow and it will continue to grow. You can't expect it to establish when the soil temperature is too low, but for an injection of protein in the spring, you could just use it as a one-off bang, let's drill in some subclover and see what happens to get us some decent lambing feed, particularly in those areas that are parched or have been parched all autumn.
What has happened with sub seed supply and development of new cultivars and so on?
Yeah, there's a number of them around, and that's what we've put a brochure together around that. So there's probably 10 to 14 subclovers on the market at the moment. They come from three different subspecies. We're trying to find out where they fit in New Zealand and whether they fit or they don't fit. There's a couple of big blousy ones, Brachycalcillium, Cilliums Antis is a very big leafed subclover, and then you've got Denmark, which is a very small leafed subclover. So just as you can get large leaf and small leaf white clovers, you can get the same sort of range out of the subclover.
Actually, that's one specific question. I'm just keeping an eye on time. We will wrap up soon. But we have one specific question here, which is an interesting one and not unusual problem. They've actually autumn drilled lucerne, and we've dealt with that issue. But now they've got a thick carpet of subclover coming through. Is there anything you can do in that situation?
Well, they shouldn't have autumn drilled.
Yeah, I think we've
have we addressed that. That's going to be a problem. It's a good sign for them, though, that the subclover actually grows in their environment, and it tells them that it's a dryland environment. They could get some herbicide and take that subclover out because it will affect the lucerne. Or actually right now, in the next couple of weeks, they could go in and graze the whole lot and just let the lucerne come back in the spring and see whether it can overtop the sub. But at some point, they're going to have to take the sub out with the herbicide, or they're going to decide, do they want a subclover pasture? Or do they want a lucerne stand? The sub is going to overtop the lucerne as it's growing at the moment and stop it being very productive. So it's actually quite a major weed in the lucerne when it's establishing, particularly from an autumn establishment.
But a good lesson there that sub's growing well in that environment.
And they should, you know, potentially think about over-drilling some next autumn into their pastures.
But you talked about that sub publication. Where can people get hold of that?
They can go on to the Lincoln University Dryland website and download a copy, or contact, send us an email and we'll get it sent out to them. So it's certainly available, and it's really the first iteration, just indicating what the different subclovers look like and where they might be useful.
Well, we might put even some details about that in the email we send out with the follow-up for this call. Last thing I want to ask about then is information around lucerne. So we had a question about getting good dry matter information on lucerne. Is it available? Where do we get it?
The only good dry matter data came really in the 80s. So there's some good data in the lucerne for the 80s on lucerne production. But just a couple of rule of thumbs. Lucerne will grow more than pasture in most circumstances. If you've got 70 mils of available water, the pasture will grow you 4 tonnes, the lucerne will grow you 6. If you've got a deeper soil, 140 mils of available moisture, the pasture will grow you 7 tonnes, the lucerne will grow you 12. So those are some ballpark figures. I know the work that I teach the students came out of lucerne from the 80s that Jim White did when I was a student, and he showed Ashley Dean 9 tonnes of lucerne and 5.7 tonnes of pasture, and he had some monthly growth rates in that lucerne for the 80s publication. So September, we're looking at around 70 kilos of dry matter per hectare per day for the lucerne, compared with about 35 for the pasture. But really, we haven't got a lot of good data since the 1980s when a lot of work was done on grass-based pastures and lucerne was occasionally put in and tested as well.
Okay, look, I'm just looking at the time. We've gone a wee bit over what I said we were going to, but we just had so many questions and comments come in tonight that I wanted to try and amalgamate as many of them as I can and address as many of them as I can. But
you've missed one, Aaron. I'd like to do one more. Horehound.
Oh, all right. That might be another call in itself. But horehound.
Horehound can be a problem, and I know people were asking about it. I'd just say difficult to deal with. But there is an action group that Snow Loxton's putting together out of Sword and Station, and he's got a survey that he wants people to fill out to try and see whether we can get some work going on removing horehound. So there's a moth evidently available in Australia that's dealing with the horehound in Australia, and Snow's leading the charge on trying to get that horehound moth looked at to see whether it's viable to come into New Zealand. So he's working with Landcare and ourselves, but Landcare are taking the lead on this one. But if they go to our website, they'll see that there's a survey available to deal with that At the moment, the best one, you know, there's options in our frequently asked questions, but the grubber is the best available.
Yeah, no, it's a frequently asked question on the text system as well. It's one of those, probably the worst weed we've got, other than some of the more brush ones like gorse and so on, certainly for lucerne. All right, but this time we've come to the end of our time. Thanks, Derek. Look, many thanks to all of you out there, the listeners who've dialed in and sent in all the questions. We were overwhelmed tonight and trying to get through as many as possible. Some of them are quite specific, and as I said, if you're not already, sign up for our Lucerne Text Management System. It's a chance to get more specific questions answered. We'll have the recording of the call up on the Beef and Lamb New Zealand podcast channel very soon, so you better listen to it again. If there's something you missed, or you want to listen to it again, and feel free to share that around with friends and colleagues. We'll send out an email when that's up, ready to go, and I'll link to a number of the things we have discussed tonight as well, so you can track them down. So finally, a very large thank you to our guest tonight, Derek Moot of Lincoln University. He took the time to be on the call. And listeners, don't forget to visit Lincoln University's Dryland Pastures website. I know it has got a lot of information on there, presentations from Derek, research papers, but in particular, as he's referred to several times tonight, a list of frequently asked questions, which is always growing as well. I know when a new one comes in, it gets added up there pretty promptly. So on that note, look, thank you all for calling in, and good night.